Arun Jayasara. Thank you for being here. I was informed earlier that you were either working on a movie or interested in working on a movie. I don't know the details of that, but I was very curious. This was third hand, so I was curious if I could get more information on that. Just curious.
That's all we've been talking about over the last half hour since lunch. Can you hear me okay? Yes, bit of background. I, like most elders in Thailand at the moment, somewhat dismayed at the rapid secularization of the society, particularly Bangkok, which in a way is a country in itself and somewhat separate from everywhere else. But nevertheless, not really seeing a way to re-engage young people. There's so much, you know, one of the things that I say is, give Buddhism a chance, you know, at least give it half an hour of your time, you know, just because the lack of interest and the dismissal of Buddhism is really spreading at a remarkable rate amongst young people. Many different causes and conditions for this, some movement to more and more middle class kids in international schools, predominantly using English language rather than Thai language, which has a significant effect, in my opinion. Plus, there's just very superficial understanding of religion, and it's something I've been pushing for for many years. You may even have heard me say that there's no such thing as religion. You can't just make a general statement that religion is like this and religion is like that and the role of religion in society is this. Because it's really important to understand that there are different families or species of religion, and the religions that grew up in the Middle East are essentially one family, or they don't get on with each other very well, as you know, but they all share the same idea of what a religion is. They're sort of more or less the same structure, and that can be summarized as belief systems. So this is the idea of a religion as essentially a belief system, belief in dogmas, and this can be verified, I think, very simply by the fact that these days the word religion and the word faith are used interchangeably. We can say the Christian faith or the Christian religion and mean the same thing, which points very clearly to the centrality of faith. The religions that grew up in India, most particularly Buddhism, is of a different species of religion, and I would characterize it as an education system. So I'm proposing this division of religions as in the major religions of the world as belief system religions and education system religions. And you cannot understand a education system religion through the lens of a belief system religion. So if you're a Buddhist, you may be, you know, a Christian will say, oh, you're a Christian. You're a Buddhist. What do you believe in? First question, okay? Because the assumption is that's what religion is. You know, they believe in Jesus, you believe in Buddha. And if they're extreme or fundamental, then they'll draw a very grim conclusion from that. But if they're more liberal, then they'll say, oh, yeah, same thing, different words, different language, you know, we're all... But this idea that the template, the belief system religion template is the template from which all religions are to be understood is one of the fundamental mistakes I think that people make. And then seeing an education system, religion through a belief system lens, means that people tend to take like one teaching which seems to kind of represent the way in which it's different from other religions, let's say rebirth. I say, oh, you believe in rebirth. You know, so that's your kind of, you know, standard belief system as a Buddhist. You're a reincarnation believer. And this superficial and inaccurate way of looking at Buddhism has spread throughout the world through the prestige of Western values and culture, both in the more formal means of education establishments, but also through internet, social media. So young people today, you know, adopt many of the criticisms of monotheistic religions that they find in the blogs and social media of young people in the West, and just apply them blindly to Buddhism. So as a Westerner coming to Buddhism, and one of the things finding the love for Buddhism is in so many ways it seems to avoid the pitfalls of monotheistic religions and those things that I rejected in monotheistic religions, not present in Buddhism, and that's something that really inspires me. And yet seeing people accusing, talking about religion, about Buddhism, as if it shared all of those features of monotheistic religion, is just such a sad thing. So it's a sad thing, but there is hope, because I say just open Wikipedia, just spend half an hour. One of the analogies I give, I don't know whether this will be as clear to you as Thai people, it's like somebody saying, yeah, I don't like Chiang Mai. You say, well, why don't you like Chiang Mai? You say, well, I don't like islands. You know, islands really bore me. I never really wanted to go to an island. And I don't want to go to Chiang Mai because I like mountains. You know, I don't want to go to like a really flat, featureless island, you know. So what do you conclude from that? If you've been to Thailand or you're Thai, you know, this person doesn't know Chiang Mai, he's never been to Chiang Mai, he hasn't even bothered to look it up on a map, you know. All he's heard is the name. And this is what we're finding. I have parents come to me and say, Tanjahan, my son came home from school today and said he's not a Buddhist anymore, he's an atheist. And just think about it, yeah. So I'm concerned and reflecting on this and a way of re-engaging young people, and it's not going to come through conventional means like giving Dhamma talks in monasteries I have a presence online and on TV and radio and all that. So I'm quite prominent as a public speaker, but I can't say that it's having a kind of a starfish kind of accomplishment. So I often thought about trying to create a kind of a drama or something that would engage people emotionally, because that's where you draw people in emotionally and prepare them to be in a space in which they can hear these teachings. Because unless you do the groundwork and people are emotionally ready and interested, it'll just go in one ear and out the other, you know, which is probably one of the few forms of emptiness that modern Buddhists are familiar with. So, I know somebody. Didn't know him so well, but he's an old friend of a monk who's close to me, and he's one of the top impresarios, pop music production companies. He also produces musicals and theater productions, and he has his own TV company, so he's quite a big deal in that world. And his dad, who's very well known, person in Thailand said, it's about time you did something for Buddhism. You've made a lot of money, you're very successful. You know, let's do this for me at least. And so the monk that he knows must say, you should speak to Ajahn Jayasaro. So I had a meeting with him and his wife and his production company, and I think the word is pitched. I pitched my, what do you pitch? I gave him my pitch, yeah. And so this idea is of a kind of a Buddhist monastic Forrest Gump. And seeing the Buddha and the great disciples and many of the really fascinating and instructive events in the Buddha's life through the eyes of an ordinary person, which everyone can relate to. And he's not particularly spiritually gifted. Everything is difficult for him. It's tough, but he sticks it out. He's there. My pitch is it would be like 9 one-hour episodes and 3 acts. So the first act would be through his eyes as a young teenage novice in about 5, 6, 7 years after the Buddha's enlightened. And then the second 3 acts are after he disrobes as a young man and gets married and raises children, in which we see many of the teachings the Buddha gave and his disciples gave to householders, and we'd also meet some of the great figures in the Buddhist lay community in the time of the Buddha. And then the last 3 acts, this is 20, 30 years on, and after a tragedy in which he loses his wife and children, he returns and to the monastery and becomes a monk in his old age and finds a somewhat different monastic order than one that he left, and kinds of different challenges and difficulties and teachings. And this leads us to him following. He's one of the group of monks who follow the Lord Buddha on the last trek from Vaisali to Kusinara, where he's cremated. And on that trek, the Buddha gave some of the most key and important teachings, so he'll be present to those as well. And then we see a little epilogue until he himself passes away. So there are two kind of strands. There's a narrative strand of his life, and then a strand of key teachings, important principles of Theravada Buddhism, introduced in a hopefully interesting, engaging kind of way. So that's the pitch, in short. Just to give you an idea, my idea is that each of these episodes would begin with a 1 or 2 minute scene without dialogue, which is aiming just to produce the tone. So in the scene where he's a novice, if you can imagine here, and you're all, let's say the Buddha's up there, and the camera's here, and the Buddha's up on a raised dais, and you won't see the Buddha's face in the whole of this. You'll only see him from a distance, or you'll see his robes, it's just not possible for a human actor to play the Buddha without sort of being uninspiring in one way or another. So so you see the Buddha's form, and then on either side, you can imagine these two aisles, arahants sitting in samadhi. You just imagine that, just to see these row after row of arahants in samadhi. And then you hear this like this. And then at the bottom of the screen is Wira, our little novice, and he's crawling towards the Buddha. So this is the scene, no dialogue, silence, and you see this contrast between this little boy, very nervous. You can imagine what that would be like, crawling along this long aisle between two banks of arahants in meditation to the Lord Buddha. And that's all, it's just him crawling, that's the scene. And then he gets to the Buddha and bows and he says, Lord, King Ajatasattu is here to see you. And that's the, and then credits. So the name of this will be Awang, because every sutta begins with the word Awang, as in Awang Me Sutang, and all Dhamma discourses end with the word Awang. So that's the reason for the other scene I'm really looking forward to seeing, if they ever, I hope we get people who can do this really well, is a close-up of a woman's hands, and very delicate and very mindful and graceful, and she's preparing fruit with her hands, and it's just so beautiful. It's no dialogue. And then after a minute or so, you hear a girl's voice, Mom, Mom, he's here. And then the next scene, you see the Buddha standing outside the house with his bowl, and the woman bringing out the plate of fruit and putting the fruit into the Buddha's bowl. So I think this would be a really... Just think about it, how great that would look, yeah. So this idea, I want it to be really, you know, there'll be laughs and there'll be tears, and then the teachings will be, you know, woven into this in a hopefully a skillful way.
Thank you for being here, Thanh Dzon. I know how lucky I am to have Clear Mountain right here in my city where I live, and just getting to be around monastics for the last few years has been life-changing. And I was wondering if you would be willing to share something about what you love most about being a monastic or about monastic life.
Well, it's like one and the same thing. So it's saying what you love about your life, because I can't imagine, you know, like a non-monastic life. I guess the first thing, as a teenager, I grew up in a rural town, and feeling very alienated from the people around me and not fitting in, and a great pull to India is the main thing, and also this search for a peer group. And at that time, this is mid-70s, I thought that of all the different groups of people that I could see, that might be a peer group with the hippies. Yeah. So I did this overland, hitchhiking mostly all the way from England to India, and hanging out with a lot of hippies and being really disappointed. One memory in Goa was the place where everybody used to hang out. I didn't stay there very long. And they would have these like grass roof cafes on the beach. And people would bring cassette tapes from the West. So you'd be walking along and there'd be Let It Bleed and Dark Side of the Moon and things like this as you're walking along this beach, and you go into I remember just one day going to this restaurant and sat down, and you had these call it like costume hippies, so different kinds of hippies, a costume hippie, and they're usually French or Italian, and they, you know, they're so, you know, I just so jealous, you know, because they had it all down. You had a certain kind of like dhoti, and you have a certain kind of knobbly walking stick, and you have a certain kind of jacket, and a certain kind of beads, henna here, certain length of hair. And it's just, for me, it was just so cool, and I just couldn't do that, you know. It's like, so 18 years old, and certain kind of chillum that had to come from a certain place in Mysore with certain kinds of, yeah, it's a kind of a whole thing, you know. And I was sitting in one of these one of these restaurants with a number of these, and this costumed hippie, lifted up his incredible knobbly walking stick. He said, "Baba, Baba, I ordered my French fries 10 minutes ago." And I thought, I could just be back in London. I mean, I thought, this is not a peer group that I want to be identified with. So that was that disappointment. So, yeah, so what I'm trying to say is, like a peer group, finding a group of people who have same ideals, same aspirations, same commitment to a moral and ethical life. And I mean, that's a treasure, isn't it? Where can you find that? And having friends, you know, not just one or two or three friends in your life that you know you could bet your life on them, that kind of loyalty and goodness, but so many, you know, literally many, the majority of monks, you know, you would die for each other. You would, you know, you put your integrity is more important than your personal comfort or even your personal safety. And this is kind of normal in a monastic order. It's not everyone. You know, there are bad monks and indulgent monks and proud monks and conceited, yes. But in terms of percentage or the majority of monks, you think, I wouldn't want to live with any other group of human beings, for sure. So that was one of like the immediate fruits of the holy life, you know, just the sense of good friendship and how wonderful that is. And you may remember where this famous case where Ananda says, "Oh, you know, good friendship is half of the holy life," and the Buddha says, "No, it's the whole thing." I mean, it doesn't mean that you don't need to practice sila and samadhi and banya, you have good friends and that's it. It means that without that, you know, without that one factor, you're not going to get very far. That's why it's like a complex machine. You know, you could have just one small cog or one small thing that if that didn't work, then the whole computer or the whole thing wouldn't work. And the holy life, without good friendship, no matter all the other elements in place and a great teacher and so on, then not necessarily going to progress on the holy life. So for me, for most monks, it's not so easy when you begin. And one of the reasons is that there's no lifetime, particularly in Thai Buddhism, there's no lifetime commitment. You can leave at any time. And also you can leave extremely easily. Usually it's done in a beautiful way with a ceremony, but strictly speaking, it's not necessary. If I wanted to leave the monkhood right now, all I'd have to do is to speak to one person and say, "That's it, I had enough, I'm not a monk anymore." And I would no longer be a monk. It's that easy. So given that it's that easy, and in forest monasteries, you know, really don't try to use all those kind of psychological tricks to keep you on board and to maintain control over people. You really do realize you have that autonomy. If this is too tough, you leave. And certainly as a monk, as an abbot of a monastery, I don't want miserable monks, you know. If you don't want to be here, go away, you know, because it just spoils it for everyone else, basically. I mean, you can, of course, say everyone goes through a hard time and you support them through that. So that's not what I'm talking about. But really, as a monk, you have to recommit every day of your life because it's so easy to leave. It's not like, oh, okay, now I make a lifetime vow and that's it. Although you may do that privately, but that's not like institutionalized. A problem for many young monks particularly is you reach some kind of challenge and difficulty and you've got so much energy, but it goes into two. It's like one part of your energy and effort and intelligence is, how am I going to get through this? And the other part of your brain is saying, maybe I don't want to. Maybe I'm not cut out for this. Maybe I just go back to lay life and have an organic farm and do good things in the world. And so monks can create incredibly realistic fantasies about, a perfect lay life, when they start to have doubts in their monasticism. So I do recommend, say, okay, if you're going to do this, and so we give people a period wearing white and as novice, like a year or more, if you're really going to do this, my recommendation, it's not compulsory, is to make a 5-year commitment. And at the end of those 5 years, review and see whether you're really cut out for this. But you can't be reviewing every day of your life. It's just a misery. So where was I going? So me, yeah, we're talking about me. So me, I'm kind of like a little bit of an outlier. And it's like, took to it like a fish to water. I just, never wanted to do anything else ever. just from the moment I walked into Ajahn Chah's monastery, and to this day, I think there is nothing that as a monk I can't do that I want to do, and there's nothing that I want to do that I can't do. So that's why I feel very happy with my choice of life. Yeah, I don't want to go on about myself too much. We can talk about it.
I have a question. I'm pretty new to the Buddhism and new practitioner, and I definitely do find a lot of challenges. I wanted to hear, when you started practicing, what was your biggest challenge? And if you, let's say, get a chance to go back to the time and tell the younger self some advice, like what one thing you'd say to yourself that might make a difference?
So I didn't hear that. If I was to go back, what would I tell my younger self? I said, you're probably freaking out now, seeing you 50 years later, talking to you, just calm down. I've come to give you some advice. It's probably the first thing I said. Well, same as everyone. You have the hindrances and defilements, and I did have very strong faith, patience, and love of the Dhamma, and love, I can say, and incredible faith in my teacher, and that was probably more important than anything else, because it's not really the intellectual understanding that sees you through the difficult times. It's this sense that this is worth it. Stick it out. There is value in this. And I think if you look in your life, some people are more patient than others, but even every individual, we can see that our levels of patience are not constant in every area of our life. There are some areas where we can be very patient, in other areas impatient. And that's an interesting topic to investigate. And I would say the areas, at least in which I've been most patient, are those in which I see meaning and value in it. If there's a point, I could do that. I'm quite tough. I could put up with that. But why? What for? And that's what undermines patience, isn't it? And so, conversely, what underlies patience is when you clearly see it's worth it. It's tough, just stick with it and you'll come out the other side. And you have examples of people who've been through this and come out the other side. And with Ajahn Chah, he would almost never talk about his strengths and his accomplishments. When I was writing his, researching the original Thai biography, going through every single audio tape and trying to find biographical information, and you know, it's like slim pickings, really, you know, like hundreds of hours, and just you find a sentence when he talks about himself, and it's like a treasure, you know. So but when he did talk to the Sangha, then he would talk about his failings and his difficulties, and he would say, look, when I started off, I was no different from all of you. You know, I had all the same problems, the same lust and anger and all these things. The only thing that made me any different from you is I never gave up. That's my chief spiritual achievement. I never gave up. I just kept going. And so as a young monk, you know, you're already inclined to put your teacher on a pedestal, and it's so wonderful. And the more you put your teacher on a pedestal, then the more you feel, little old, I'm just so hopeless, I'll never be like my teacher, you know, and he's so wonderful. And so Ajahn Chah is very skillful, you know, he wouldn't let you do that, you know, he's saying, look, I am where I am now, not because of some special being, but because I put the work in. And if you put the work in, then you can do this too. So it was incredibly empowering. So yeah, to begin with, it's physically, it's going to Northeast Thailand, the climate, particularly at Wat Nanachat, it's a miserable climate. I hate it. I mean, it's only kind of, you know, the only time, there's probably a month of the year, you know, you can turn to somebody and say, oh, nice day today, you know. Yeah, like a month out of the year. And it's hot, but it not only is it hot, it's sticky. And as a child, I had asthma throughout my childhood. And so I have this, I'm not exactly traumatized, but I'm very sensitive to like stuffiness and stickiness and lack of ventilation. And it's kind of very, probably more than most people. So I chose to live like 20 years in this environment where, like in the hot season, you feel like you're swimming through the air, you know. It's like, it's that thick, you know. It's like the Dead Sea, you could lay back and it would sort of hold you up. So that was physically. And of course, you know, get up really early in the morning, before three in the morning, and 10 or 11 before you get to night. So you, eating one meal a day, and sometimes working really hard physical work on one meal a day. And we didn't have all the tonics and things that we have these days. You know, we could get a hot drink, sweet drink once a week. You know, you say it was a real treat. You know, so this is a kind of a good old days kind of thing. You know, in my day, you know, they don't know they're even born. If, you know, this younger whippersnappers, you know, they've got it made. They don't appreciate just what we went through. Yeah, so I won't inflict that on you. No, but it was pretty harsh and pretty hard. So that we didn't have electricity, and so there were no fans and no relief that way. And when we do these evening sittings in the sala, which is a corrugated iron roof. And you have to wear your robes, and it was, if anything's going to put you off meditation for life, it would be an evening sitting in the sala at Wat Nanachat in those days, because it's so sticky and hot. Within 5 or 10 minutes, you can start to feel your angsa is starting to get wet, and now your jiwon's wet, and it's just, you can just feel the sweat all through your body. And as you sweat and it's evening, the mosquitoes start. So you're hot and you're sweaty and it's like, so meditation is just gritting your teeth and getting through to the hours up. And then you can go back to your kuti under your mosquito net and really meditate. That was kind of, yeah, so, but I loved it all the same. I hated it, but I loved it. You know, and Ajahn Chah used to say it's a bit like, you know, if you eat really spicy food, you know, it's like there's tears coming down. It's like, ah, so it's great, you know. It's like so spicy, you know. It's like chicken wing going, And it's like that, you know, it's like, yeah, it's tough, but, you know, you wouldn't want to do anything else. And it gets easier, of course.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Ajahn, for coming to Seattle. And thank you for giving me an opportunity to ask this question. Sure. In monastics such as you, there are two main qualities that seem to manifest. One is an almost infinite compassion and kindness in everything that you do, and also an incredible discipline to uphold the precepts, the vinayas. It's almost you have to be super tough inside. Anything you'd like to share that will help we lay people emulate you?
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite so heroic as that. I mean, it's like it's everyday life, and you know, you don't always, you have aspirations, but you don't want to, you know, no one's compassionate 24 hours a day and in every situation. I mean, that's the goal to move towards. But this idea of a compass and moving towards that and keep coming back to that is really important. And the Buddha, Ajahn Chah used to have a saying that we repeat both to the monks and to the lay people, is if you look after your precepts will look after you. And when you see that clearly, then, you know, it changes your, you realize just how much you owe to your precepts and how much you cherish them and treasure them. So it's not like, I can't do this and I can't do that. You know, you're like this in this cage of precepts and preventing you from being your real self or something like that. You know, it's just giving you real tools of clarity and mindfulness about your actions and speech with a precision that you wouldn't be able to attain without that kind of structure. Again, the precepts, the monastic precepts, are not kind of cut and dried. You know, there is room for discrimination and for judgment. And I told this story a few days ago. I'll repeat it now. I'm going to tell you my least favorite Zen story. Okay. And then my least favorite Zen story, you will have heard it, and you'll probably say, why is that his least favorite Zen? That's one of my favorites. So I'm going to tell you why as well. So this story is about these two monks, and there's one's called Kovilo, one's called Nisipo. We'll leave them, they're in the second act. So the first act, this is the story first, okay. Sorry, I got ahead of myself. So these two Zen monks are walking through the countryside, and there's a young woman standing by the side of a river, and she says, oh, help me, I'm all alone, it's getting dark, and I need to cross this river. And one of the monks is looking a bit, and then the other monk picks her up and carries her across the water and puts her down, and they carry on their way. And the monk who's carried her across noticed the other one kind of stiff, and he hasn't spoken for an hour or two. He says, you know, he's angry with me. Anything wrong? How could you do that? How could you carry? Don't you know we're not allowed to do that? Carry that woman across the water? And so this is the punchline. Yeah, I just carried her for a few seconds across the river, and you're still carrying her now. So, okay, who likes that story? Who thinks that's a good story? Okay, now I'm going to tell you why I don't, see if you change your mind. So, why I don't like this story is because it creates a false dichotomy, a false choice. The idea is there are two possibilities. One is you keep your rules and act like this kind of hard-hearted lump of stone who doesn't care about what happens to young women abandoned by the side of lonely rivers in the middle of the night. Or you can just put these rules aside for a while and let compassion take over and carry her over and just let go of that afterwards and dwell in emptiness and something like that. So I don't think that's really the case. So now we're back to Venerable. So they're walking along on Tudong, and then they come to this lonely river, and they see Wanida, and she's standing there and said, "Tanajan, help me. I'm all alone. It's getting cold and dark, and I don't know anybody. Help me." And so what would Ajahn Kogalo and Ajahn, I don't think they pick up Wanida and carry her over the river. They would say, "Wanida, there's a village a couple of kilometers back. We'll take you back, and we'll ask someone to put you up for the night." Or we can say, you have to get over this evening, then we'll take a detour. There's a bridge about 2 or 3 kilometers up this way, and we'll go around that way, and a bit longer, but we don't mind that. We can take you. Is that okay? Okay, yeah. So rather than accepting this kind of stereotypical idea of rules that sort of just kind of repress your humanity and just adapt to this kind of heartless sort of framework of what you should do as a monk and what you shouldn't do as a monk, and that the alternative to that is to be kind and compassionate and not take these rules so seriously, this view is you have these rules, these are your life, these are your culture, these are the things that you've been given to by, you know, your father, the Buddha. These are the things you uphold. Your integrity lies in keeping these rules. So you think, how can I help Wanida? How can I help this poor young woman without breaking my rules? And then you start thinking, you use your intelligence. Oh, well, we can take her back to that village, take her to a bridge, or we can say, "Wanida, get out your phone and call her Uber." You know, there are just so many more possibilities than this story. So, okay, who's still thinks this is a good story? Thank you. I feel that, yeah.
Ajahn, I've been trying to do death contemplation. When I think about that, it's just kind of a blank reaction. Like, yeah, I might die.
No, that's wrong. You will die. Okay, you got started off on the wrong foot altogether already. Okay, carry on.
So I might die on the way to the car, but there's it's kind of like, and then you wait for the emotions to come in, and it's just like, okay, well, I'll try again. I might die by the time I get to the car, so it doesn't really penetrate. So I'm wondering how to actually get the alarm bells ringing, you know, just like all the time.
Yeah, so we can divide meditations into two groups in one way. One is talking about discursive meditations and non-discursive meditation. So, like, breathing is a non-discursive meditation. You don't have to use your thinking mind at all. But sometimes, you know, especially if you lead a busy life and you come to meditate in the evening, it's just this momentum of thinking. And it's just so hard to switch mode into a non-discursive object like the breath. And so sometime to begin your meditation session with a discursive object is just taking that thinking energy and saying, you can think, but think within these boundaries. Think on this particular topic. So you're giving your mind a little bit more space, a little bit more room, a little bit more freedom. But you need to have a strategy and to write down the particular progression of reflections on death. So there's things like everybody dies, everybody who's ever lived in the world, everybody who's living here now, everybody who will be born, everybody will die without exception. There are young people, old people die, young people die, babies die. And so as long as you're on that particular theme, you can think about it. Memories, things you've seen in movies or in documentaries on the news and history and things you've read. As long as so it's not one-pointed on a sensation or on a word, but you're allowing that little bit of freedom to think, but it has to be on that particular topic that everybody dies. But nobody knows exactly when they will die, so the uncertainty of death. And if you have some good examples from people you know or things you've read about, this suddenly out of the blue kind of death, that's good. So you have people that's like steady kind of decline, deaths, unusually rapid deaths, and so on. So you're thinking about the uncertainty of the time of death. Another point would be the uncertainty of the kind of death, whether it's from some internal disease, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, or from an accident, or from whatever. And then this, I too will die. So that's the culminating one. But this is not like a quick fix. You know, it's not like just, I'm going to die. You know, I might have a car crash on the way home and I'm going to die. Suddenly, you know, this is going to click. It's hard work. You have to just keep going on to it again and again and again and again until you develop a certain power of contemplation, and then it can happen. You can start to observe some changes taking place. And two things. One is there's a certain kind of emotion, a kind of sober sadness that can arise from this contemplation. And when you see that emotion arising, you focus on that. But the other thing that will often happen with these discursive contemplations is after a time, your mind just says, I had enough. I don't want to think anymore. And there's a kind of sense of weariness with thinking. And that's when you're ripe for breathing meditation or a non-discursive object. So in other words, these discursive meditations, such as a death meditation, are very good to develop just as a tool in your toolbox. As though it's not like your main meditation, but it's a good thing to have if you find it getting a bit lazy and neglectful. It's a good one to bring up a sense of urgency. If you're in a meditation retreat or in a monastery, or you're having like a whole day or like extended periods to meditate, it's good to have a little to change things up every now and again, not to get stale. And that's one of the things you can just introduce to freshen things up. And then as a prelude to the non-discursive meditations, either to create a particular wholesome emotion, which can then be your object of meditation, which arises as a result of that contemplation, or simply that sense of weariness with thinking that arises even with a directed and disciplined kind of discursive meditation. In other words, it will give you a ripeness and a readiness to go into the non-discursive meditation.
Thank you, Dhanajan.